Peter Johnson introducing another program in the Catholic Heritage Series broadcasting from England, bringing you traditions, trips, and stories from our Catholic past, and inspiration for our Catholic future. The Yorkshire Dales have much to tell us about our Catholic past, and the days when the monasteries and abbeys formed a central part of English life and culture. They fulfilled the role today played by hospitals, clinics, hostels, and welfare systems. Through the abbeys and monasteries, the poor were helped, the sick given treatment, knowledge was passed on, and hospitality offered to wayfarers and travellers. Monasteries were also centres of music, history, and academic knowledge of many kinds. Tim Matthews has been visiting Yorkshire.
In pre-Reformation days, the Cistercians in England owned vast tracts of sheep grazing in what is now known as the Yorkshire Dales National Park. Within that 680 square mile area, there are four main dales. There's Narrow Swale Dale, Broad Wensley Dale, Winding Wharf Dale, and Rolling Ribble Dale, with a host of minor dales wandering off them. Well, recently finding myself in the town of Ilkley, I decided to head up Wharfdale and Coverdale towards Richmond to visit the cloud-capped fells, to listen to the curlew and revisit some of those quiet Yorkshire villages with their cobblestone streets. And first, close to Ilkley, I came to partly ruined Bolton Abbey. It was in 1135 that Alistair Romilly decided to establish an Augustinian priory at Emsby near Skipton to be dedicated to St. Cuthbert, I quote, "for the good of my soul and that of my husband and those of our parents." Well, for some reason or other, that initial plan never really got going, and Alice agreed that her priory should be founded at nearby Bolton. Her new priory was to be dedicated to Our Lady, but somehow she managed to get St. Cuthbert's name squeezed in too. So the priory of St. Mary and St. Cuthbert was founded and continued to flourish over the years. When King Henry VIII came to dissolve the monasteries, it was one of the last to go. It was then only a priory, but it was elevated to the rank of abbey in 1880 by courtesy of the local railway company, when it built a nearby Bolton Abbey railway station. Waymark paths take you on a good walk from the priory ruins, which were frequently sketched by Turner, along the banks of the Wharf through Strid Wood Nature Reserve to humpbacked Barden Bridge. Lots of people have drowned trying to hop across the river here, so that's not recommended. If you complete the whole circuit, the walk's about 7 miles long. There's a good hotel at Bolton, the Devonshire Arms, owned by the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire. From Bolton, I headed up across the fells towards Jervo, a beautiful and exceptionally peaceful sight. The abbey here was founded in 1156 by a group of those sheep-keeping Cistercians from Byland's Abbey, close by the modern Benedictine Abbey of Ampleforth. The monks are said to have been guided to the site at Jervo by a vision of Our Lady. The last abbot of Jervo was convicted of high treason for converting part of the abbey plate for the use of the Pilgrimage of Grace. Imprisoned in the Tower of London before his execution, he scratched his name on his cell wall, Adam Sedbar. You can still see it there today. I had with me an old guide to Britain written in the 16th century. Of the next place that I visited, Richmond, it told me, "Richemondia, commonly Richmond, is enclosed with walls of no great compass, yet by suburbs which shoot out in length to the three gates. It is pretty populous." Well, especially so I found on market days when the crowds are gathered outside the supermarket and the cobbled car park is jammed with shoppers. Otherwise, not a lot has changed in Richmond over the years. It's still dominated by its castle, whose massive walls are amongst the oldest surviving military walls in Britain. The castle was built in the 11th century to guard the valley of the Swale, Swale Dale, through which shoots the fastest flowing of all English rivers. The parish church at Richmond dates mostly from the 13th century and contains some fine sculpture and a cast of the Easby Cross. The original Easby cross, which dates from 800 AD, is in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Within an easy walk of Richmond's town centre, well under 2 miles, past water meadows and shady woods, you'll come across the fairly substantial ruins of Easby Abbey, a pre-Monks detention monastery which was founded in the 12th century. The Abbey, St. Agatha Juxta Richmond, was founded in 1152 on the left bank of the River Swale by Roald Constable of Richmond. After the dissolution of the monasteries, its gateway was used as a granary. There are substantial remains of the old buildings, unusual in their layout because of the sloping site that demanded special drainage. In 1536, the canons resisted Henry VIII's suppression of the monasteries, and many of them were hanged. Their canopied monastic stalls were removed, and they are now in the parish church in Richmond. The abbey ruins are now in the care of English Heritage, and they are open at any reasonable time.
In the Middle Ages, English pilgrims went to some of the holy shrines throughout Christendom, and people from other countries visited England's holy places. Pilgrimage, as Chaucer reminds us in his Canterbury Tales, was a major feature of Catholic life and culture. Going on pilgrimage was the main way of visiting new places, and it brought together people of different languages and nations. Often, new ideas, music, styles of dress, or even items of food would be brought from country to country through the great pilgrimages of Europe. While people from France and Germany, Italy and Spain visited English shrines such as Canterbury and Walsingham, English pilgrims often made the journey to Compostela in Spain. Joanna Bogle takes us there.
Puisque le monde je quitte pour vivre au ciel heureusement. Il faut que mon Jésus j'imite, la Vierge et Saint-Jacques le Grand. Vive Jésus, vive Marie, prions le Sauveur maintenant, qu'il nous fasse à tous la grâce d'aller à Saint-Jacques le Grand.
That's one of the traditional pilgrimage songs, along El Camino, the way. The way to Compostela in Spain. El Camino, the way, is one of the most ancient pilgrim routes across Europe. It goes through France and Spain to the great shrine of St. James at Compostela in Galicia in Spain. To this day, pilgrims flock along this route. What's the origin of this extraordinary manifestation of faith, and what connection has St. James got with Spain? St. James was one of the apostles, brother of and fellow fisherman with St. John. He's sometimes called James the Greater to distinguish him from the other apostle, James the Less. With St. Peter and St. John, he was chosen by Christ to be a witness of his transfiguration and also of his agony in the garden at Gethsemane. And these two apostles with St. Peter seem to have had a sort of precedence among the 12. He was the first of the apostles to be martyred, dying at Jerusalem in the year 44, being put to the sword by the order of King Herod Agrippa. An early story relates that his accuser subsequently repented, declared himself a Christian, and was beheaded too. St. James's feast day is the 25th of July. Now about that link with Spain. According to Spanish tradition, St. James visited Spain and preached the gospel there, and thus his body was brought to Spain after his martyrdom. There isn't very much evidence for all of this, but it is certain that devotion to him there goes back to at least the 7th century and possibly before that. His shrine at Compostela in Galicia is certainly the site of a very early Christian burial ground where an unidentified saint was buried. In the year 835, Theodomir, Bishop of Iria, is said to have been guided by a star, hence the name Campus Stella, to this very spot in Spain, and there to have found the body of St. James. A chapel was constructed, and the place became an important bishopric. A more substantial building was begun in the year 868. That was destroyed in the next century, but the relics that were in it were preserved. Pilgrimages began. In the year 1078, the great cathedral, which still stands, was first begun. And from that time onwards, this has been a great centre of pilgrimages, not just for people from different parts of Spain, but from right across Europe. St. James was very important to the Spaniards as their patron saint in their long struggle against the Islamic invasions, the Moors, which were of huge significance not just to Spain, but to all of Europe. And in the Middle Ages, the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela had enormous popularity across Christendom. An encyclopedia, published in the 1880s, says, "The city became, in fact, the focus of all the art and chivalry of neighbouring Christendom, and a spot where conflicting interests could meet on neutral ground. But the days of pilgrimages are past, and though the Congregation of Rites declared in 1884 that the cathedral still enshrines the veritable body of the apostle, pilgrims are scarcely more often seen than in any other cathedral town." Well, that certainly isn't true today. Pilgrimages to Santiago de Compostela are enormously popular in the 1990s. People still walk the way to Compostela. They also go by train, by plane, by car, and even by bicycle. They go on sponsored walks, they go on private pilgrimages, they go in groups. Walking to Compostela, flying to Compostela, simply being part of the pilgrim route, has never been more important, and looks set to be part of Catholic life right into the 21st century. What do people see when they arrive at Compostela? A stunning cathedral with two towers over 200 feet in height, reached by a flight of steps, flanked by statues of David and Solomon. A statue of St. James above the main doorway. And inside, among other features, the largest incense burner known, the Botifumero, a huge swinging incense that comes right down the main aisle, and watch out to make sure you're not in the way. Authentic pilgrims, those who've walked all the way and can prove it by having stamps on the card that they carry with them, can also claim a free meal by going to the back of the hotel, showing their card and being adequately fed. Dr. William Griffiths has made the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela more than once and really knows his way along El Camino.
The traditional methods of making the pilgrimage are on foot or on horseback, but bicycles or mechanical horses are nowadays allowed.
And is it something you do entirely alone, or do you meet other pilgrims on the way?
One certainly meets other pilgrims. I myself began my pilgrim experiences in a little group of friends, and then as I acquired more confidence the following year, I went with just one companion, and after that I went on my own, and have made some wonderful friends whom I've met along the way.
Now, the route, of course, would take you, you're English, so you'd be starting in England, across to France, and then through France to Spain. So where, for practical purposes, once you met the mainland of the continent, where did the route start?
Well, we know about this from the world's oldest guidebook, which was written in the 12th century by a French monk named Aimery Picot. And this guidebook can be found in a manuscript in the Cathedral of Santiago. And he describes how there are four roads through France which converge on the Pyrenees, on the mountains which form the border with Spain. One of these roads starts in Paris, and that would be the road closest to England for a pilgrim in the Middle Ages coming overland. Then another road starts at Vézelay in Burgundy, which is the tomb of St. Mary Magdalene. A third road starts at the shrine of Our Lady of Le Puy, and the fourth road starts in Provence, in the south of France, in the city of Arles.
So each of these places and the places you visit on the way are themselves rich in history and well worth visiting.
Oh, yes, indeed. And not only the places you start from, but the places you pass through along the way. Wonderful churches, wonderful places of pilgrimage in their own right.
Is it the case, because I've heard this, that there's some kind of pass or stamp that you can get that you get at each place you pass and that this proves you're a genuine pilgrim?
Yes, indeed. In most countries, including the United States, there is now an association of pilgrims to Santiago. And through these associations, you can get a pilgrim record, or credencial, as they call it in Spanish. And as you pass through each place, you get a stamp from the churches or the town halls or even, if necessary, the bars along the way. And when you arrive in Santiago, you present this record to the office of the cathedral and are given a magnificent Latin certificate that you have completed the pilgrimage.
Which you now have hanging on your wall, presumably.
Yes. Well, I have one of these fine certificates, which are known as the Compostela. And I also have a Grade B certificate. I got my Grade B certificate for a rather short pilgrimage, which takes only 3 days walking from the seaport of Corona. And this is on the north coast of Galicia. And so in the Middle Ages, English pilgrims would sometimes sail directly to Corona and then walk the short distance from there. That nowadays only entitles one to a Grade B certificate.
Now, what about staying overnight on the way if you're walking across France and so on? Well, where do you sleep the night?
Well, there are in Spain and in France many places which have hostels, especially for the use of pilgrims. Some of these are run by parishes and religious orders, some are run by the local municipality, some are run by families and individuals. And in all these you can get a bed for the night, first come, first served. It may get a bit crowded in the height of summer. Failing that, there are small inns where one can stay. And if it really comes to an emergency, one finds extraordinary kindness from people. There has been more than one night when I've been put up on the floor of a school or of a village gymnasium. These have been some of the most wonderful nights that I have spent on the Camino.
Is it, in any sense, a real religious experience, then, as well as one of friendliness and so on? Was it for you, and do you think for other pilgrims, a really spiritual thing, as it would have been in the medieval times?
Certainly, yes. The reason that this pilgrimage is so alive today is that it is a pilgrimage to the tomb of an apostle, to the tomb of the apostle who went furthest in preaching the gospel, who chose to preach the gospel right at the end of the world, taking literally Christ's command to the apostles. He preached at the end of the known world, which was in the northwest of Spain, and there St. James is buried. And his tomb has drawn pilgrims from the time of its rediscovery in the 9th century to the present day. Now, not everyone making the pilgrimage is a Catholic by any means, because this impulse to go on pilgrimage is something which appeals to many people for purely human reasons. They can see life as a pilgrimage. They can feel that they are following in the footsteps of generations of previous pilgrims. And often people who start out on the road without any explicit spiritual motive will discover that spiritual motive.
Even now, even at the end of the 20th century, and do you think there's a sort of revival of this?
Certainly. Year by year, the numbers of pilgrims making their way to Santiago has gone up. This year in particular, the numbers are very large because this year is a holy year. That is, the Feast of St. James, the 25th of July, falls on a Sunday. And by a papal privilege that was granted in the Middle Ages, Santiago declares a holy year whenever St. James's Day falls on a Sunday. The last time it happened was 1993, and the numbers of pilgrims in that year were the largest that had hitherto been known. This year, the numbers are even greater, and people are pulling out all the stops to make accommodation available for them. And I myself am looking forward to being in Santiago on the Feast of St. James as part of the medical team, looking after any emergencies that might occur in the cathedral.
Because you are a doctor, a family doctor on the outskirts of London, aren't you? What about the walk, then? How long does it take, and what are your feet like towards the end of it?
Well, it all depends where you start from. Some people want to start the pilgrimage from their own front door. But if your front door is in England, or still more in the United States, you have a considerable stretch of ocean to get across first. So you could start at any of the four points that I've mentioned in France, or further down the road at one of the two places where one can cross the Pyrenees, cross the mountains into Spain. Now, if you chose to do that and start on the French side of the Pyrenees, you could walk to Santiago in 4 or 5 weeks. Your feet, by the end, will have ceased to trouble you, but they will trouble you a great deal before you get to the end.
And finally, one of the things that happens on the way is that people sing songs. And I gather that part of this revival of pilgrimage has been a revival of some of the old pilgrim songs.
Yes, indeed. We've been very fortunate that in recent years some first-rate musicians have produced recordings of the traditional music of the Camino. To name just one, which was produced in England, the New London Consort under Philip Pickett have a beautiful set of two CDs called The Pilgrimage to Santiago. And, of course, the songs are not just to listen to in a concert hall or on a disc, they are to be sung as one makes the pilgrimage.
Well, come along then. Obviously, you've got to give us a song.
Well, here is a verse of a French song, Pour avoir mon Dieu propice. Pour avoir mon Dieu propice, vive d'aller en Galice, vive d'aller en Galice, voir le Saint-Jacques le Grand. J'entreprends cet exercice, non pas comme un fainéant. Prions la mère de grâce, qu'elle prie son enfant, qu'au ciel puissions avoir place, près de Saint-Jacques le Grand.
And very roughly, what was that saying to us?
Well, here is a rather free translation. I am walking down this footpath, and I really need a good bath. And I really need a good bath. Is this fever on the brain? No, it's God's will that I do this, that I'm walking into Spain. Holy Mother, what a bother, pilgrimage is now my fate. If I ever get to heaven, put me near St. James the Great.
We hope that you've enjoyed this look at some of our Catholic heritage. There'll be more next time, so we hope you'll join us then. If you have any comments or snippets of history or information, do write to me, Peter Johnson, at Catholic Heritage, EWTN Global Catholic Radio, 1500 High Road, Vandiver, that's Vandiver, Alabama, USA. 35176, or you can email us at radio@ewtn.com.
A prayer for families. O God, in the beginning you brought together man and woman in holy marriage that they might share your work of creation and bring enriching life to one another. We commend to your constant care the homes where your people dwell. Knit together in growing affection those who have been made one flesh so that their love may never fail. Turn the hearts of parents to their children and children to their parents. Take away the roots of bitterness, vanity, and self-seeking that bring dissension where family peace should reign. inspire them rather with loyalty, faith, and sacrifice, that in all the changes and circumstances of life, they may stand strongly together in mutual service and love. We ask this through Jesus Christ our Lord, who grew within the family of Nazareth, who loved the church as his beloved spouse, and gave himself up for her. Amen.